Welcome back, everybody. This is the Product Uncensored Show with your host, Colin Pell. And first off, Happy New Year. It is 2021. 2020 just really passed by so quick. We're going to be talking to our guest about, 2020 as well. So, and we've got, of course, a great guest, but let's go through the house rules before we start. Number one, I write at www.productuncensored.com. I actually wrote an article last year, just really talking about how the year has ended for me and also for Product Uncensored. So if you want to check it out, it's there. Secondly, all our videos are on YouTube. And of course, if you go to YouTube, I would like to request that you please, click on the subscribe button. And when you do, also click on the bell icon so that you will know whenever something new is published, you'll be the first to know. Thirdly, our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms. It should be showing up here sometime about now. So yeah, have a listen over there. And finally, if you really like this show and you want to support the show, there will be a link here somewhere where you can support this show for the price of a coffee at buymeacoffee.com. Okay, that's all the boring stuff. I want to get into all the fun stuff, which is today's episode. Today's guest is a well-known guy in the product and design scene, highly respected. He's also the founder of Webcam KL. And as with all Malaysians, he's obviously a foodie. He's an all-round funny guy. And most importantly, he's currently the chief product officer at Mind Valley near Wuhan. Welcome to the show, Wuhan.
Hey, Colin. Thanks for having me over here. And thanks for sharing all those lies.
Yeah, so I think Wuhan's
so journey... so gracious of you.
Yeah, Wuhan's journey has been a really interesting one, and one of the reasons why I was keen to get him on the show was is also because he comes from a design background. So you know we hear a lot of stories about product managers becoming product leaders. But what is less common is a product design lead becoming a product, the head of a product team. So that's one of the things that I thought would be very interesting for our listeners and viewers. But, we'll have lots of time to do that. So let's start with, Wuhan, before we even get into the introduction, right? I've always wanted to know, how do we actually properly pronounce your surname? Is it Niao?
So I'm actually from the Hakka descent, Hakka dialect. So the Niao is actually the Hakka pronunciation of my surname, last name. The Mandarin phonetics is actually Rao, R-A-O. So even more confusion, right? Like, the Chinese pronunciation is Rao, but the Hakka pronunciation is Niao, right? So there's no correct way to pronounce it, but if you wanted to be dialect accurate, is Niao. Yeah. which is really not a common sound that you'd expect to make. So it's okay, it's fine. I learned to live with it. It's all cool.
Yeah, actually now I kind of regret asking you that question because I still don't know how to pronounce it. So let's stick with it. I'll just call you Wuhan and you'll go from there. Yeah. So yeah, why don't you, give our listeners and viewers like this, 5-minute summary rundown, pretend, I'm hiring you to be the next chief product officer.
Oh, cannot lah. 5-minute impossible lah. That's why all my career jumps has always been, me, right? Okay, what I can do, right? But the too long didn't read is that like what you just shared, right? A product guy who came from a design background. To go even further back, my first job was actually a developer. I was actually a programmer. I actually started out as a programmer, as a system, as a systems programmer, full stack developer, and then became a designer. Some people who know me, I don't think this is your final form yet. So I think right from day one, I would say product has always been in my blood. Even as a programmer, it was never just about, oh, you know, just code this, just code that. It was always about, okay, why do you want me to code this? What, you know, what is this function for, right? What purpose is it supposed to solve? Is there any other similar function, or is there other similar products which can do this already, so that we can, you know, so that we can look at it? And I've always been somebody who's like putting my work into two buckets. Somebody has already done this and done this well, so you're just copying. Or nobody has done this, and therefore you need to, you know, put a bit more thought process into it, put a bit more inquiry into this. And I think this simple bucketing has really helped me prioritize work, has really prioritized resources, and it has continued to lead me to where I am today, like, as a supposed acting head of product at a very dynamic company.
Very interesting. So when you were saying that, you know, two buckets, whether it's been done before or whether you need to put more thought, was it that I can copy from Stack Overflow versus I cannot copy from Stack Overflow?
Last time, where I got Stack Overflow? I mean, that's how old I am.
Yeah, that's true,
how old I am. There was no Stack Overflow, but we had something similar. It was the PHP. Some people are going to go, oh my God, right? The PHP forums.
Yeah.
You know, there was no back then when I started work, there was no Stack Overflow, but I suppose those original OG coding forums was the ancestor of that, lah. It's a lot less kind of like purpose driven, I suppose, back then, more primitive, lah, right? So you're kind of like, you think of a solution, and then you think that you want to use this particular function, and then you search for that function on the PHP forums, and then you see the comments there, and then people will be like saying, like, oh, you know, I use this function in this way to solve this problem, right? Things have definitely evolved a lot more from that. But yeah, you know, there was a version of Stack Overflow last time, but you still needed some assembly required, lah.
Of course. Yeah.
So the whole so for me, I've got no issues with that, because that is how you start to adopt like best practice, lah, right? By actually figuring out how everybody else is practicing it.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, yeah. I was trying to make a joke about it, lah, but obviously it became this very serious answer. So okay.
I still do that. You know, even as a PM, right? We go to the WhatsApp, and then we, you know, hey PMs, how do you guys do this? How do you guys do that?
sure, yeah. I mean, but that's what the community is for, right? I think communities are so important.
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, that what you just mentioned about, you know, starting off as a developer. So you studied in Curtin, and then you graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Information Technology. So how does that, or how did it happen from, you know, studying IT and computer science, you know, to being a developer, and then suddenly you switched over to design? It seems like this sudden switch. Of course, I didn't know you back then, so yeah, it'd be good to know, yeah, what made you want to go into design?
So like I say, right, as a programmer, people need to appreciate that this was pre-agile. The new tech companies were
what year was this?
And
this would have been 2007. Okay, so it would be like, yeah. Pre-agile in Malaysia. More like that. So
yeah, pre-agile in Malaysia, but I think the rest of the world was also just starting to, you know, get agile, right?
Just starting to get sexy.
So a lot of the new, a lot of the IT companies was very much still, you know, we know waterfall, but we actually can't afford waterfall. So let's figure something out, right? When I first took up the job, I was basically getting the design specs from somebody, right? And then like, here's the requirements of doing, you know, solving this problem. And I remember distinctly looking at what I was supposed to build and seeing the UI design. This was not a customer facing thing. It was a back office thing. And I was like, you know, this design is horrible. You know, even back then, right? I was like, this design is horrible. I can code this. I can code anything, right? But this design is horrible. And I suppose the fire and the passion of a fresh grad trying to prove himself, right? I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to build this thing according to this design spec, but I'm also going to build another version, right, where I think is way better. And then I presented this to my manager, right? And then my manager is obviously like, oh shit, you know, you designed this, you know, this other thing. I was like, yeah, I did, you know, and you did this too at the same time, like, yeah, you know. And that basically started lah, the whole like how I transition to design, right? First, I still have to do my programming job, but gradually, you know, the management started going, hey, why are we paying a design team or design company when this one guy can design and code, right? You know, the Chinaman DNA is like, yeah, yeah, you know,
cheap labor.
And that's how I really just transitioned to both the definition of full stack was kind of like that, right? The guy who can design and also code. Today, the definition of full stack is a little bit different. Design tends to be still opted out. Unless you are just saying like, oh, you can't afford a UI UX, I'm just going to use a standard library, right? Which is great. Don't get me wrong. I think that's great, right? Because that's the evolution of the practice. Yeah. So that's how I, you know, went from programming to a designer, and then as my career progressed, it became the whole design work became just as complex as the development work. So gradually my portfolio was like 50% design, 50% development. I was getting rustier at development, you know, when you start getting people who are more focused and more dedicated, they do code a lot faster. And the organization that I was in found that it was harder to find good designers. So then my split became more, you know, 60%, 70% design, 20% technical solutioning. And, you know, just over the course of a few years, it became 100% design, minimal development. And that was roughly about the time when Ruby on Rails exploded. And in kind of like in my to-do list is like, if I still wanted to stay up to speed as a developer, I need to learn Ruby on Rails, right? Because I just mentioned just now, from PHP, Ruby on Rails. But the nature of my employment was that, no, we can't afford to give you time to learn Ruby on Rails. I still remembered, like, because we hired some fresh Ruby on Rails guys from Finland, right? And I was like, yeah, you know, I want to learn Ruby on Rails from this guy. Never happened. Because the volume of work, right? Just like, oh yeah, yeah. And then as the year went by, like, yeah.
No.
There's just so much stakeholders to manage, so much iterations and prototyping to be done. Just the UX domain. That it was just impossible to even find time to say, oh, I'm gonna code Hello World in Ruby on Rails. Even to this day, I'm like, that's as far as I got.
Okay. So that's how you got into design. So was it a conscious decision for you to want to sort of, you know, excel in the design space, or was it just, well, I won't say just, but was it something that happened kind of organically? You felt like, you know, you did this job well and decided to pursue that path into design.
It was the latter. It was definitely the latter, right? Like I mentioned just now, right? When I first jumped into IT, maybe it's also the context of that period, right? Where I was already like, you know, more focused and interested in developing things that actually made a difference, right? Even back in those days, I was like, you know, we can't be building something that's going to be used by so many people, and those people are going to be so frustrated using it. To me, even from day one, it's about solving people's problems. And it just so happened that, you know, it started out with, as a coder, how can I solve people's problem? Then as a designer, how can I solve people's problem? Then, you know, so it was definitely a latter thing rather than it wasn't a map where I say, I'm going to start my life as a developer, then become a designer, then become a product guy. It was more like, I want to solve people's problems. And at this point in time, with the skills that I have, I should do this to solve people's problems. Then, you know, so it's a very organic growth.
I'm beginning to
eventually see... it'll be like, you know, as a you know, as a CEO, you can solve people's problems, then yeah.
No, I was gonna say, you know, that it seems to be this trend, right? That that the product leaders that I find who are, you know, really passionate and who are really good at what they do, they all have this similar trait, which is they are all busy trying to solve somebody else's problem, you know? So I always thought that's an interesting thing, right? You know, so if you're not the type to want to put your face somewhere else, you know, put your finger in everything and try to fix stuff, I think maybe product for you may not last very long. But yeah, I think I'm recognizing that with a lot of other leaders as well. Because they all start with, I wanted to solve this problem. And then, you know, then it just spirals out of control from there. Then suddenly next thing you know, hey, I'm a product person.
It's definitely in the, I think it's in the blood, right? I've been to design meetups. I mean, when I say meetup, I mean like the really like just hang out and have a drink meetup, lah. Not the talk meetup, lah, okay? The designers meetup, nobody wants to talk about work. Hardcore programming, you know, meetup also don't really want to talk about work. But you go to a product meetup, you're having a beer. What are we talking about? Oh man, I've got to deal with this person. No. How do you deal with this? You know, we don't switch off one somehow or other, you know? Even when we go to a restaurant, right, we are already like designing processes, especially if we go to a very busy restaurant, right? Oh yeah, you know, they should just change the workflow here. Like this. It's in the blood. We enjoy that, right? So there's no actually like, you know, switching off.
Very true. Yeah.
We look at a restaurant, we are like, if I'm product managing this.
How could I have improved it?
You know? Yeah. We look at the menu, like, oh, just UX is not good. you laugh, but that's true. Every time we hang out, we're like, oh, you know?
Yeah, that is the case.
We make a joke of it, right? But the truth is that, you know, we are never switched off.
That is true. Okay, so I want to sort of move this into then you going to Mindvalley. I believe that, you know, after you sort of transitioned into this design role, is that when you also are moved into Mindvalley?
No, actually. I think if anybody's following along and opening up my LinkedIn just to fact check me, right? I was 7 years in Mindvalley. I had a lot of fun there, so I stayed that long. But because of my you know, solving problem mindset, by the seventh year at Mindvalley, I've largely had a really solid design process and workflow already, right? I guess I was looking for the next. I was already kind of like looking for something else to do. The opportunity to join Maxis came along out of the blue, and it was the decision was really like, hey, you know, you've already spent 7 years, you've established such thick, solid roots, you know, in Mindvalley, quite cushy work life balance, so nice, you know. And then this corporate opportunity came along. Back then, I guess the age was like, yeah, you got to YOLO one more time, you know. People were all warning me and telling me, oh, you're going to die in corporate. It's going to be horrible, blah, 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 blah. Why you give up this thing? Why you give up the thing? But I suppose I'm like, I think that time also I was like, was I having four kids already or three kids? I can't remember. But I was like, okay, like, let's do this. At least go, and then if I don't like it, then I figure something else. And I went to Maxis, and it was great. So when I joined Maxis, it was supposed to be just a UX design role. Like, the expectations was I would join the corporate way of doing products where I'm just going to sign off what a vendor has proposed, you know. And again, some people who know me would joke about it and say, you can, man. Somebody will show you ugly design, and then they're going to tell you, can you just sign, you know, because we already spend months. It's like, you know, going through all the stakeholders already. You don't go and tell us like, you know, you don't like it now. You know, we just need your name only so that we can proceed. And in the beginning, I was like, okay, some of these things are smaller. It's okay. Then the big things started happening already, coming in. And I couldn't take it. I couldn't tune out. I was like, this design is hor-, you know, I was like, this design is horrible, right? And then people would tell me like, oh, but this, we have already reviewed this with the head of, you know, some other department or whatever. We already reviewed it. They were showing the big gun flex, right? I was like, no, my role here is to sign off and say there's no UX issues here, right? And I think at that moment when I refused to sign, approve on this thing, this is vendor work. When I first joined Maxis, I wasn't hands-on yet. It was literally I was supposed to be just a rubber stamping role. And somehow that just started, I don't want to go into the details, but that just started like for me to get my hands dirty, right? Like how on earth did such horrible UX come to fruition? And it went all the way to CEO level. I was told an unprecedented, fairly long session with the CEO of Maxis back then. He shared with me, I don't want to share that private convo, because maybe some other people in corporate might be tuning in, but the gist of that was kind of like him explaining to me where is his area of even a CEO. I think we shared about this before, right? Knowing your circle of influence and knowing your circle of concern, right? So that was what he coached me. He explained to me, right? Because I had a laundry list of, you know, talking about product development and design and stuff in the telco, right? And he explained to me the concept of circle of influence and circle of concern, right? So he explained to me clearly, CEO, you know, here's his circle and here's his area of concern. And he defined to me what is my circle of influence and what is my circle of concern. And that helped tremendously, right? The unspoken rule of, you know, as a this person, your circle of influence is actually this big. Go forth and solve the problem. I think that was amazing. With that definition, I just went nuts lah. You know, I basically just started like, oh, it really wasn't just a rubber stamping role. It was really about, you know, here's a clear thing we want you to solve. Go and solve it within your domain. And the way it was defined literally led me to helping to build out the product culture in Maxis back then. So even though my title was principal of UX, it was actually a Trojan horse to get the organization to start to in-house product ownership. And building the initial kind of like the initial practices of product management. So 1 year of me getting that sorted out, and then 2 years of practice, learned so much. I mean, it's interesting because it was like it was also a learning experience for me, to go from my background was kind of like, you know, startup, five people in a room, product management, to existing enterprise with 3,000 people, maybe 100 people in your particular consumer facing division. How do you go from zero to a semblance of product management there?
Well, I guess what we would be talking about,
that was really fun. Yeah.
I guess what we'll be talking about in this case is, you know, moving from, you know, to a more, I would guess, a more robust version of product management, right? Because in enterprises, what I seem to see, and this is, you know, my unverified view of the corporate, you know, from my experience there, is that I think because everything is so structured and everything is so focused, right, it's very hard sometimes to actually have like real ownership of what you do. And like what you say, right, it sounds like, you know, sometimes you just have to be like, you know, this rubber stamp approval. It's like literally just, you're not even a filter, you're just one step in this whole big machine. And I think the challenge for most enterprise companies is to move away from that into what you were saying, you know, really giving ownership and the autonomy for the masters and the crafts of their role to actually get things done.
I don't want to say this little experiment worked out well for Maxis and as Telco lah. I don't want to say lah, right? But if I take a step back, the parallel here would be in this level of enterprise, right? You actually have got a company that is actually damn good in something. As an example, Kodak, right? A huge company, damn good in film, right? Damn good in film processing. You know, that's your core business, right? Lots of money, lots of capital. But you have a CEO or leadership who says that, you know, we want to be innovative. We want to disrupt ourselves. Very, very hard one. Very, very hard one. You know?
Yeah.
So it was actually a very similar situation when I was driving this agenda in Maxis. The core business is doing great, it's doing well, it's infrastructure, right? But the CEO wants to see whether can we do something else.
Mm.
So it was that kind of context when I was, you know, my three years in Maxis lah. Mm.
Mm.
Whether at the end of the day, beyond that, because sometimes this sort of innovation disruption, it really depends on the CEO, the top leadership, and then obviously the alignment with the board also lah, right? So it just so happened, right place, right time, you take a stab at it. What happens after that is again, you know, at an enterprise level, decisioning is hard to, I mean, you don't want to speculate there. Mm.
Yeah. Okay. So before I think we lost you there for a bit. Okay. I think we jumped a little bit ahead into Maxis. I actually wanted to talk a little bit more about your time in Mindvalley. When you joined Mindvalley, I think it is very nascent years, right? I think how big was Mindvalley there when you first joined?
Well, I also can't remember already, but by the time I left, so when I joined Mindvalley, I think it was at most 20 people around there when I first joined. When I left Mindvalley, we were already about 200 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess it was
on a scaling.
Yeah, so that was what I was very curious to sort of understand from your experience, right? Scaling the design team and the design culture, you know, how do you do that with a team of 20 and what changes when you are going from 20 to 200? Also curious to know, like, when you, because your official title was head of design, was there a product team there as well, and you know how did you guys interact?
So like I shared earlier as well, right? I'm kind of old. when about the year that my last year in Mindvalley was actually when we started to formally recognize that, you know, there might be this layer product management. Prior to that is project management lah, right? It's the culture in Mindvalley then, we never even formally like even called it product management, right? Whenever we built something, it was either a mobile app or it was a platform. And the people involved in the development of this thing would be the UX designer, one developer, and endorsement by the CEO or the CTO.
Mm.
That's it. That's basically the product team, right? We don't even call it a product team. It's a project, right? And we had a lot of these, right? And some projects lasted longer and some projects were one-off. Right? So from that kind of like history, you kind of like go, you know what, these long-running projects, they fit the definition of it requires product management really, lah, right? Mm. Even at me as a head UX role and an executive role, we started to realize that the project managers for these long-lived projects, we cannot just simply swap them out because it doesn't make sense. Yep. You know? Mm. So when I left Mindvalley that time, it was only just the earliest of realizations of, you know, product management practice, fitting in the vision of Agile, right? The company was already practicing some Agile, but not Scrum or anything. So when I left Mindvalley, it was just the beginning stages of people who were already building stuff and releasing stuff very quickly, right? And studying Scrum and studying Agile and go, hey, actually, yeah, we are already doing most of those things, right? But we just didn't know what to call it, right? And there was definitely this, after I left Mindvalley, like, this period of like trying to bridge this, you know, how Mindvalley used to do things versus how, you know, we started hiring Scrum, we hired our first, you know, product owner per se, and it was messy, lah. It was definitely messy, lah. Because the founders were very hands on with project management back then, right? And these people who were hired were also relatively new into the practice, right? Mm. You literally hired somebody who just got Scrum certification or somebody who just got the product owner certification, coming in, and they were quite textbook about it, right? So there was about a 5-year period when I was, you know, when I was doing my hustling in corporate, when I still keep in touch with my former colleagues in Mindvalley, and then they're sharing with me all these things. And for me, I'm like, oh my God, you know, I don't have a first-hand account. This is like a third-hand account, like my former colleagues just sharing with me. It sounded like it was pretty rough, lah.
Mm, mm. Okay.
And that was the basis of kind of like how a company struggled with agility. I want to put it very specific here, right? You have a startup that was pre-agile/scrum, right? Who knew how to do things, who knew how to figure things out. It seems to be working out well. That's why they scaled up, that's why they were able to hire more people. And then suddenly they want to introduce, you know, a structure or a process in, right? Fundamentally, it was a change management problem, right? How do you evolve? And I think a lot of startups of a similar age would probably know what I'm talking about, right? If you were in that interesting gap era, that was rough, right? Mm. And some companies today in Malaysia, I won't name names, but some company has handled that transition much better. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So struggling with agility, how to adapt and stuff and so plus the, you know, you try something for 1 year and then it didn't work out. And then now you got to try something else. Eventually you run out of systems, right? Then you're like, oh crap. So how?
Yeah. Okay.
And then they call me.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit, right? So you did, you know, you had your software years, you had your product design years, you know, then startup Mindvalley, then you do your whole, you know, existential crisis into corporate, trying to understand, you know, how to make yourself relevant in such a big industry. So what? How did it happen that you ended up back at Mindvalley, and this time you went back as the chief product officer? What happened? Mm.
So because of my background, being somebody who has got the development background, I won't say engineering. I know a lot of people are like, you know, figuring out are you a developer or an engineer? I would say I'm a developer. My developer background. And my product design background, UX background, and starting to collect my portfolio of actually product skills, right? My from the Maxis days to my next few hops, my role has been quite Trojan horsey. You know, it's like, oh, a lot of the upstream stakeholders is like, because the symptom here is that, you know, we spend so much money on an app, we spend so much money on a platform, by that time UX was a buzzword now.
Mm.
Right? User experience, customer experience, right? And the tendency is who's the most, I hate to say this, but who's the most famous UX guy in Malaysia, right? And my name tends to pop up, right?
No, it's true.
And it would become a Trojan horse. It would become a Trojan horse role, right? Like what you asked me right from the start, right? Can you tell me a bit about yourself, like as though you're interviewing, right? My subsequent career hops has been, look, I don't hire me to convince you why you need good UX, right? It's more like if you're ready to roll up your sleeves and just fix this thing, then only we have a chat, So those opportunities came, went in, thinking that same like Maxis, thinking that I'm just gonna rubber stamp stuff, or I'm just gonna be a band-aid solution to the UX problems. But it was always more than that. It's always more than that, you know. I lost my train of thought. So you were saying, like, you know, how did that happen, right? Yeah. So every one of my career hops has been kind of like intent. Like I need somebody to fix my UX. Call me, I go in and I reveal to them, like, it's not a band-aid solution, right? And every time I hop, the CEO, the founder of Mindvalley would reach out to me and say, hey, I didn't know you were looking, why you never tell me? You know? So I was like, ah, yeah, you know, bro, don't like that, lah. So after the 2-3 hops, then last stint, when I was very aware, when I was quite aware then that, again, because of the thing that I do, right, is like, you know, you have a bigger problem, not just a UX problem, right? And then I knew already whether the organization was ready to commit to that. So I knew I was looking for something else already. Then I was like, you know what? Out of respect, I better tell the CEO of Mindvalley. Hey, I'm exploring now. I know you keep on telling me, like, you know, why I don't tell you, so I'm telling you now. And yeah, you know, because of that, then they're like, oh yeah, you know, if you're looking, then we do want to hire you back, you know, to do this and do that. And then went through a series of conversations and discussions, not too dissimilar to what we're talking about right now, right? You want me to solve this problem. Go deeper. What exactly you want me to solve? Then we narrowed down to actually the root cause of the thing, and then form the role that would make sense for me to solve the actual problem. And that's how I came back to Mindvalley. I think for me, actually all of my career hops have generally been you know, Wuhan, we, you know what you need to do, lah, okay? So whatever title you want, lah. That makes sense, lah, you know. So
that's a good problem to have, right?
And I mean, for me it's like, you know, that startup thing for me, lah, is like, you know, I would like to be the even the product people, all of you product people, like, y'all know we joke about this, actually our title should be Chief Garbage Collector, you know.
Oh well, or I know one product guy who used to say that, you know, my role is to shovel shit, and, you know, shit cleaner. So
it's like, yeah, you know, yeah, if you want my title to be telegraphic, head of problems, you know, any problem come to me.
Yeah. Chief problem officer sounds good.
Yes. I mean, but that's not sexy. VC, you know, that's not sexy. You can't put that in the corporate website, you know. So we kind of like get all corporate labely about it. So we are product. Hit a product.
So since you've joined back at Mindvalley, right? This is pretty much I think your second role, like doing full officially in your title, like full product. Yeah, I think this was it. Yeah.
What do you mean?
I mean, would this be? Would you consider this your big product role? Like, would this signal the transition from product design into product management, or was it for you purely ceremonial?
No, it's the latter. It's really, like I say, when I left Mindvalley, even though the title was head of design, I was already actually, if I were to reflect back, a lot of my things was actually already product related anyway. You know, kicking off the discovery, getting the alignment. You know, it just so happened that, you know, at Mindvalley, I was the PM/UX designer. In a way, even PO. Actually, I would say that even by the time I left Mindvalley, I was PO/UX designer. I was a product owner who can design my own prototypes. I can design my own UI/UX flow, right? And I could defend it. So I would say it's just I would say it's like it is definitely ceremonial, but it's also kind of like you've been doing something all along, but there was no industry accepted title for it, right? And then suddenly now you're like, oh yeah, you know, we should call it that.
Yeah. So now,
if you ask me, the work has been the same.
Okay. So now that you're going back into Mindvalley in this position where, you know, the company is so much larger than when you left it, you now have a wealth of experience under your belt working in a big enterprise or a few enterprises. What have you sort of, what learnings have you put in place to your role in Mindvalley now? Like, what do you think have been the main things that you have done as the chief product officer at Mindvalley?
It's only been like less than a year that I've joined back Mindvalley.
9 months,
and,
I think.
Started to address. Yeah. It's still relatively short. I think in corporates, you actually get a 1 year onboarding. Before you have the press release. I mean, I was just looking through my LinkedIn, right? I'm seeing like some of my peers who are now taking on like really senior roles, right? They are like, and then when I follow up with them, they're like, oh yeah, I've been doing this for 1 year already, but don't wanna announce yet, you know? And I think that's prudent. I think that's correct, right? You're jumping into an extremely senior, like you say, product leadership or whatever leadership role, right? And the problems are getting more complex. It's not just about your technical skills. It is really about figuring out the landscape, figuring out, you know, who are the upstream people you need to align with, how's the situation with the downstream, do you have the right team to support you, especially when you're jumping in, right, from an outsider coming in thing. And 1 year seems about right to onboard you know, that type of level of leadership, right? So it definitely do make sense to lay low, don't tell the whole world so soon, because, you know, in 3-4 months you might be like, you know, crap, no, this is double A one, you know, and it could for some people maybe it's actually not good for your reputation to say like, wow, you know, you only stay here for so short while. If you see my LinkedIn, you know, I definitely have some of that too. won't name names. So for me, if you ask me as a CPO, what has been the most important thing that I have started working on in terms of product
Yes.
Is actually upstream management. I think it also depends on the type of organization that you're in. In some organizations, you do have when I say upstream, CEO and below until it touches you right? That's a whole upstream layer. Depending on the complexity of organization. You might have very hands-off upstream. You know, people who just give you a budget and then they'll check in on you 1 year later, right? you will have a different, you will have a different challenge to manage that upstream, right? Normally that one very numbers driven one, okay? We ask you to spend this amount of budget, you know, what's your ROI, or how much waste have you reduced, right? Or you have an organization where your upstream is a little bit more hands-on, you know, quarterly. You require quarterly updating or quarterly handling of that. Or in the case of Mindvalley, it is a very, very hands-on upstream with almost like a weekly cadence that requires you to interact with them, right? And that requires a different style of managing already. It requires a different set of practices to allow that smooth interaction. So I would say is that tuning and tailoring the product practice to support such an upstream requirement.
Mm.
To put it in a very technical parlance.
Mm. Yeah.
You want me to write a user story?
But the interesting part that comes out of this, right? You were talking about, you know, the differences between you know, your stakeholders who are hands off, hands on, and very hands on. And the question would be, in your case, you were mentioning that the style of the culture of the company that you're in has a very hands-on stakeholder. How would you manage that? Because I think the tendency is we see that the more hands-on they are, it also usually means that the more they want their say. And it's not a bad thing. I think in a startup, you can't run away from that, right? In startups, it's always like that. But I guess the question would be, yeah. How do you manage that? Because this is like I was saying just now, this is no longer the 20 man startup that has been. It's now, I don't know, you guys are a few hundred strong already, and it's definitely a different game. So how do you make sure that you manage the expectations without sounding as if you are taking, you know, you're not valuing their input, and also that, you know, you don't want it to get shade the way you make your decisions?
I mean, you already summed up the problem perfectly because of your experience, right? You are like, you already defined the problem.
Yeah.
You already defined the problem. And that is the problem that I have to solve, right? It's really about engaging with this upstream, these stakeholders, right? And figuring out exactly, you know, why are you like this? Right? And you find out why. No, when you find out why, that informs what you need to do, honestly.
Mm.
Honestly, right? Because Mindvalley has tried to hire some senior people to try to do this. I think that, you know, this is where the experience comes in. I think they were great. I think they were great experience wise, but this nuanced skill, where for me it's like I say, I didn't want to become a PO or PM because I wanted to be a PMPO. I became a PMPO because I want to solve people's problems. For me, the first step is kind of like, okay, you know, what is the real problem here? Right? And if the problem here is, like I say, in this case, is an upstream downstream disconnect. That's the thing that we need to solve first. Zoom it down here, right? And just by identifying this pressure point, just by bringing up this elephant in the room, has actually diffused and decompressed the tension. I feel that moment of catharsis when I was explaining to the downstream. And then I had my coaching session with the upstream and getting both sides to see and realize that this is the issue was actually a very, to me, it was like, my job is done. Call me next year, you know?
I had one question.
But to get to that, yeah.
Sorry.
But to get to that state, it was a careful kind of like, you know, you're still expected to do your PM stuff, but how do you get people to realize, you know, from a defensive, unsafe, untrustworthy environment, how do you get them to open up? You know, even this is upstream and downstream, by the way.
Mm.
You know, that was the one that require. I don't think there's a textbook for this. It is very much an EQ. It's a very much EQ, empathic thing and stuff and so on and so forth. You know, and I would say that this is something. This is definitely something worth exploring and talking more about as the product practice also evolves. I feel. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, the question that comes out of this, which I'm very interested to hear your take on it. So I've spoken to a few product people, you know, product managers who are probably not as experienced as you, obviously. And one of the feedback I've always found interesting is some of them feel like, you know, hey, I need to find this company where I get, you know, full autonomy. And, you know, because, you know, my current role, you know, I've got my boss always trying to tell me what to do. And I find that interesting. Let me explain to you from my perspective first, and then, you know, feel free to put in your thoughts, disagree or whatever, right? I feel that, is that something that is, you know, when you read the books, right, it always tells you about this, and it's beautiful. But I find that in reality, it's not always the case of autonomy means you getting your way. It just means that you need to be better at trying to find a way that works for your organization. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that, because sometimes it feels like, you know, everybody tries to follow the latest book out there that tells you about how your role is such a heavy responsibility. And I don't know, sometimes it feels like that's like, you know, hunting for a pot of gold, you know, at the end of the rainbow.
Mm, yeah. I mean, this is very, very much related to what I shared about my conversation with the Maxis CEO. Have a transparent and honest conversation with your upstream. What is your circle of influence? Right? Have a very, very clear, like, you know, bro, you know, I can do all these things. This is the menu here. I can do all these things. What do you want me to do? What is it that you want to do? Share the responsibility. Nothing wrong with that.
Mm.
Share the responsibility, but make it very, very clear, the working agreement. That will already help a lot.
Yeah.
That will already, already help a lot.
Agreed.
You know, if you can't even get to that level, if you can't even get to that level of commitment with your immediate, you know, your manager, maybe it's beyond that, right? If you can't get that honest alignment, right, it's gonna be rough. It's gonna be very, very rough.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always this, right? Case
because,
about
because the... you will be, yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
You'll be the cause, because you are not aligned there, right? You will be the cause of misalignment, right? Because you don't even realize you overstepped, right? Then the downstream is like looking to you, right? I thought you are in charge of this thing. Then somebody above you is like, no. You see if you don't align there. The rest of your stay there is very susah.
Yeah. I think you bring up a very good point. And you know, I'll just try and summarize it in some form for listeners and viewers as well. It's about having this very transparent conversation about, you know, and I think it's a lot to do with trust as well, because you're essentially trying to build the trust that, you know, I can do this, but at the same time, I think on our part as product leaders as well, we have to also trust that, you know, our bosses, or you know, in the case of if you're very senior, your CEO and you're in a startup, that they also know what they're talking about. And it's about trying to understand where both are trying to get to. Because again, I think if you're listening and, you know, you're having this frustration about, you know, oh, I'm this product manager for the web platform and I never get a say in what I want to do because my boss is an ass, you know. I suspect a big part of it is also there is this issue of trust. And I would say that, you know, that's a primary issue that needs to be solved. And if you cannot solve the issue of trust, the issue of autonomy it's not even worth talking about.
Off the table. It's off the table. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Hmm.
I was just going to build on top of your autonomy statement as well. It is about trust, right?
Mm.
and the scale of your organization will solve this thing differently, right?
Yeah.
In a startup or a startup like environment with less corporate structure, trust is very
effective. Sorry, can you repeat that about the part about, right, the startup environment?
But in a corporate setting, in an enterprise setting. Yeah.
Sorry, you were cutting out. So can you repeat the part about
I was bleeping out, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Can. So trust, right, in a startup or a startup-like environment is much more subjective. It's much more emotional. It's much more personal related, right? However, in a corporate setting, because your video has froze. Hello?
Yep, I'm seeing you.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. So, in a corporate setting, trust is accelerated because of the corporate structure in place, right? Your upstream don't necessarily have to trust you subjectively or emotionally because they've already done the due diligence before they hire you. They've already background checked at you. They've already seen your historical performance and they have set aside a budget for you and they set very clear boundaries for you, right? You don't deliver on that, you're let go. That's the trust. The trust here is a mechanical thing here now, right? We hired you to do this thing, to solve this problem. If you solve it, you're good. You don't solve it, we need to talk. Different type of trust. Right? But the second way is very scalable if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You are the company, the organization is very aware of revenue, money in, money out. Right? So you are able to scale very rapidly like this because you don't have to invest so much time in trusting people. You already bucket your budget to say, this budget I can write off, this budget I cannot write off one. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that informs you what type of trust you need. From a value chain point of view.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's how you see when the startups get that huge big funding, right? They will evolve to the second form.
Yes. Yeah. But that's always the challenge because move from, you know, the place of, you know, it is a very personal, sort of like a very sacred thing of trust and autonomy. And then you move into the more enterprise role where you need to scale. And you need to be able to move. Well, I mean, I guess that's the irony of it, right? You want to move faster. And so you start putting these things in place. And then suddenly when you hit a certain size, you just realize that you become slower. So then you sort of have to reinvent yourself and have to start up within the enterprise to sort of get that going again. So I guess it's always this cycle. But you're right. I think at an enterprise level, the trust is a different kind of trust. And I guess that's the indictment against enterprises is that it's most times when you get too big, that trust becomes a soulless, worthless thing, right? Because it's based on what you can bring and what you can do, and nobody cares about the fact that you're an absolute ass and you treat your team badly because you bring in the ROI. So I guess that's always the tension.
Yeah.
Right? It brings me.
I mean, that's the pattern. Yes.
Yeah. It brings me to one question that I wanted to pose to you as well, because you have experience in startups, you've had experience in enterprises, right? And both of them were in, you know, product capacities as well. So what would you say was the best thing about, you know, working as a product person in startups? And what's the best thing about working as a product person in an enterprise environment? The one, like just one of each.
Honestly, both same. The people you get to work with. It's always about, for me, every hop that I stayed significantly long, is because I enjoy working with the people. Within my solar system. Because for me, I'm very much guided by the principle of when I wake up in the morning, do I look forward to dealing with my upstream? Do I look forward to working with my peers? Do I look forward to working with my downstream within my immediate, you know, second or third degree? Most important is upstream. For me, it's most important is upstream.
Yeah.
Because they are probably the single largest possible source of stress for you. and you want to kill that stress first. If you've got stress there, if you've got tension there, my advice is you have to solve that first, because that is your foundation of being safe and trust as well. I would advise people, if you're growing up in your role, as you get closer to your upstream, you suddenly need to realize this, you know, especially when you're suddenly like plucked, or maybe whoever that was between you and the upstream, or whoever's between you and the exec level, let's say they move on, and then you've been promoted. I'm just observing, right? Sometimes, and people just assume business as usual when actually it's not, you know. If you are not getting that relationship sorted out, you should either try to solve it, or you have to be ready to move.
Yeah. If you can't change the company, change the company.
Yeah. And I would say the upstream one is the hardest one, because when you can solve that, everything else is a bit easier.
Agree. Yeah. Those are really, 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 really good thoughts. And I really like especially the last part, you know, where you're talking about is really the people that you work with and really removing the primary source of stress. So that's really good stuff. I wish we could continue longer. Maybe I'll get you back for round two, because there's so much more. But I think we need to go to the last part of the show, which is where I ask you about the song that you like. So let's. I'll let you do the introduction to the song.
So the truth is, since I've taken on this product role in Mindvalley, I've really haven't had even the time to even enjoy music, listening to music. I'm just hopping from one meeting to another meeting, right? But whenever I do need to get into flow, to reduce the cognitive load is always going to be something that doesn't have lyrics. Right? And normally when I'm going into flow, it is trying to tackle really complex problems, whether it's people problem or product problem or definition problem, whatever. And what I find gives me that spurt of energy to just carry on is actually epic music. More epic, more better. You want the music to be even bigger than whatever you're trying to solve, because then at least it gives you a bit of purpose. So for me, For me, the musical choice tends to be if my life right now is an action movie or a fantasy movie, what is the backing track right now, you know? So take it away. I've got a long list. This is the one that I have been finding myself playing on loop a little bit more often than usual, because I like the fact that it starts out calm to ease me into the whatever stuff that I gotta do, and then it kind of brings you to that, you know, you're gonna reach Mordor and you're gonna throw the ring into the fire and everything's gonna be fine kind of vibe. So I like kind of that. I like the fact that it's giving me a sense of hope. that you'll be able to solve these things soon.
All right, so you chose the song Ether by Peter Rowe, right?
He's a great composer.
I think you're the second. By the way, you know, the link to the video for Peter Rowe's Ether is going to be up here, I think. Yeah, and I was going to say that
enjoy.
You're the second person to say, you know, you want this musical epicness to help you in your you know, quest to focus. The first guy was actually Pratik. So Pratik, his recommendation was Hans Zimmer. Yeah. So it was very interesting to when I, you know, you sent me the song and then I was listening to it, like, oh wow, okay, this is very different. It's very, you know, it's very similar to Pratik. Yeah, but you're right. Sometimes to reduce cognitive load, you know, this kind of, you know, lyricless music is also good. But I don't know, for me, if I want lyricless music, it's more lo-fi ambient, because the epic songs, actually same problem with lo-fi as well. You sometimes can get lost. Like, it just takes you somewhere, you know, and then suddenly you realize that, hey, you know, now I'm suddenly, like, hey, I'm supposed to be trying to get into flow. I don't know whether you have that problem. So actually, for me, I don't do that. I have to listen to like some pumping music to make sure that, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm getting things done. Because if I listen to an epic lo-fi too much, right, I get transported somewhere else, you know.
I think it depends on what I'm doing. Like, am I doing a more like maintenance thing, or am I crafting the product vision kind of like thing? Then it will change. I do lo-fi too.
Okay.
But it depends. Like, I think it really depends. Yeah.
Okay. So wait.
But
so
lyricless is definitely the base criteria.
So lo-fi is for when you're doing maintenance or when doing product vision stuff?
Maintenance, like grooming. Oh my God.
So and then the epic one is when you're trying to craft the product vision, is it?
Yeah. The grooming is like lo-fi. Lo-fi as much as possible.
Nice.
When I'm going through, like, oh my God, why people name this thing wrongly? Or I need to change all the labels. Or I need to, you know, put all the things in the correct epics. Oh my God.
Nice. All right. Thank you so much for you know, being willing to share, and of course being very open about everything that you've gone through. Is there like, you know, some famous last words, or you know, some advice or some anecdote that you want to leave with our listeners and viewers before we end the show?
Man, I knew you were gonna ask me this, and I was supposed to be prepared for it. I don't know the exact phrasing. There's a line from, I don't know if you guys know about this movie called The Exotic Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. There's a line there where it basically says, everything will be all right in the end. So if it's not all right, it is not the end.
Mm.
I really like that line. You know?
Wow.
And it fits my approach to, you know, the problem solving thing and stuff and so forth, right? As long as we are set on making things all right, right? Whether it's from a product point of view, from your team point of view, or whatever, don't give up. You want to be able to leave that behind, right? And I think with, you know, yeah, that's all I want to say, actually.
Nice. All right. So thank you so much, Wuhan, for being on the show. Really appreciate it, as I mentioned just now. And for the rest of you, I hope that, you know, this is something that, you know, will help to kickstart your 2021. I know for me, 2021 was supposed to be a year where we start, you know, going out again. I still harbor hopes that will happen soon. Unfortunately, it's been a sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Extended, you know, when extended, homebound because of COVID and things like that. So I mean, stay strong, and I really liked how Wuhan ended it. You know, it's not all right. It's not the end. So keep hanging on in there if that's you. You know, you think you're losing your mind because of COVID, but at the same time, always know that this is not the end. So of course, this also means that this is the end of the show, but it is not the end until the next episode. So thank you so much, everyone. You have a great week, and we'll see you at the next episode. Bye bye.